Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the plunge in oil prices following the recent OPEC meeting at which Russia, Iran, Nigeria, and Venezuela were unable to get the Saudis and the Gulf states to agree on a cut in production to raise the price of oil. A leading expert and analyst on energy issues, Fidel Geit, who is the Senior Vice President for Oil and Gas Research with Oppenheimer & Company, joins us to discuss the role of shale oil from fracking in creating the current glut of oil on the market and the coincidence that the governments the U.S. has problems with in Russia, Iran, and Venezuela are all oil-dependent economies whose budgets are severely impacted by falling oil prices. Then we will look into the Pope's recent visit to Turkey as the first foreign head of state to visit the grandiose billion-dollar, 1,000-room White Palace built by Turkey's president, some suggest, to house Erdogan's giant ego. Graham Fuller, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA and the author of Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East, joins us to discuss Erdogan's polarizing and authoritarian leadership of the new Turkey, an increasingly Islamist and nationalistic state which has refused to allow the U.S. access to a key airbase, calling into question Turkey's membership of NATO and it is increasingly at odds with the U.S. over its strategy in Syria. Then finally, we will hear from Antonio Gonzalez, the president of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, the largest and oldest nonpartisan Latino voter participation organization with more than 14 million registrants in 2012. He is also the president of the William C. Velasquez Institute, a leading think tank that studies U.S.-Latin American relations, and he's just returned from Cuba and Venezuela, and we'll get an update on the increasing factionalism within the ruling United Socialist Party of Venezuela as the government struggles to deal with rising crime and inflation and a shortage of foreign exchange due to falling oil prices, which have dropped from $99 to $69 a barrel since June and are the source of 96% of Venezuela's foreign exchange. And joining us now is Fidel Geit, who's a Senior Vice President for Oil and Gas Research with Oppenheimer & Company in New York City. Mr. Geit has more than 30 years of experience in oil and gas research and has previously been with Mobil Oil and J.P. Morgan Company in New York. He is one of the most quoted analysts on energy issues and has testified before the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives about oil price speculation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Fidel Geit.
Thank you for having me.
And let's deal with the first question, which is the role of shale oil from fracking in creating this current glut on the market. How much is this contributing? And we're being told now that the United States will surpass Saudi Arabia soon as the world's biggest producer of oil, having already passed Russia as the world's biggest producer of gas.
The shale impact is very profound, very hard to quantify. But we are producing more than 2 million barrels a day of shale oil that did not exist only 10 years ago. That is bigger than the production of Kuwait. That is almost the production of Libya and Iran combined. So it is very important factor, and it really created a structural change in the global supply.
But my understanding is that it's expensive to extract oil this way, and that the falling oil prices will reach a point soon where shale oil is not economically viable.
Well, a couple of things. Technology continued to improve. Only a few years ago, we needed $90 oil to justify wells searching for shale oil. Today, we can make money at $65 oil. So the people who are saying that driving oil prices lower to drive shale producer out of business, all I have to tell them that I will believe it when I see it. I think the companies will respond very strongly to lower oil prices. they will employ more technology, they will tighten the belt, they will cut costs, they will negotiate a better deal with suppliers and contractors. So all in all, I think the industry is much more resilient today than any time in the last 30 years.
So then let's turn to the geopolitical aspects of the consequences of the recent OPEC meeting at which Russia, Iran, Nigeria and Venezuela were unable to get the Saudis and the Gulf states to agree on a cut in production to raise the price of oil. It seems to me more than a coincidence that Russia, Venezuela and Iran are countries that the U.S. has problems with their governments.
Well, a couple of things. We have to realize that there is no cure for high oil prices better than high oil prices. The longer oil prices remain high, the more capital will be allocated to other sources of energy or other sources of oil production, which we have over the last 10 years, and that is shale. If we didn't have the $100 oil, the shale industry, nobody would be talking about it because there would be no shale oil industry. The same situation with the Canadian oil sand. Only 2 years ago, or 4 or 5 years ago, we needed $90 oil to justify opening a new mine in Canada. Today, they make money at $60 and $65 oil. So, technology will continue to advance. Companies will break even at much lower price level than any time in history. And this trend will continue. We have not reached the bottom yet in terms of lowering our break-even point. I do believe in the next 2 or 3 years, we are going to see oil profitable below $50.
Again, I'm speaking with Fadel Geit, who's the Senior Vice President for Oil and Gas Research with Oppenheimer & Company. Mr. Geit has more than 30 years of experience in oil and gas research and has previously been with Mobil Oil and J.P. Morgan Company and is one of the most quoted analysts on energy issues and has testified before the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives about oil price speculation. So what you're telling us then, Fadel Geit, is not good news for alternative energy, wind and solar. And we've already noticed, apparently, in terms of the automobile market, that the sales of SUVs and trucks, pickup trucks, are going up rapidly, whereas the sale of electric cars like the Tesla and hybrids like the Prius are going down.
Yeah, but longer term, the trend is still for energy conservation, for more efficient cars, for more efficient industries and housing. The global economy today is much more energy efficient than any time in history. Our GDP growth rely on fewer BTUs than any time before. The European even are much more advanced than we are. The Japanese are the same. So again, you know, all these things happen because of rising oil prices. Rising energy prices make people more creative and will, you know, at the end of the day, the market will balance itself out. Without government interference, without additional regulation, there will be a balance. We don't know at what level, but it is going to reflect supply and demand. We cannot separate oil from politics. We also cannot separate oil prices from speculation. These are the things that people have to understand, that it's not only supply and demand, but there are factors like the, you know, political factors as well as the financial speculation, which unfortunately the government has failed to regulate.
So in terms of then the countries that the U.S. has problems with, and the P5 plus one, that's the permanent five at the United Nations, along with Germany, that have been negotiating with Iran for a deal. We know that there's been in effect, a proxy war going on in the Middle East between Iran and Saudi Arabia for some time. And clearly the Saudis would be happy to put pressure on Iran, which apparently is the strategy to get them to come to the table, even though the deal wasn't struck by the deadline last month or this month, about a week ago. The long and the short of it is that That pressure will continue, I imagine, until and if and when a deal is done. In terms of Nigeria, well, Nigeria is such a hopelessly corrupt country. I'm not sure what you can do about that, since so much of the oil money is stolen by the elite. And then the issue of Russia, which is not a member of NATO, not a member of OPEC, but was nevertheless in Vienna for negotiations to get the price of oil to rise, to have it rise because of a cut in production, which of course they failed to do. Venezuela we'll be talking about later in the program. So let's start with Saudi's role in keeping pumping oil to keep the price low, and how much it relates to the proxy war with Iran.
100% correlation. It is not a coincidence that the negotiation with the five plus countries, the timeline was extended by 6 months. So as the OPEC decision to review the oil price policy also postponed for 6 months. Basically, the longer it takes oil prices to stay low, the more pressure is going to be on Iran and on Russia. The best thing to punish Russia for what it has been doing for the last 6 months or so is not obviously a war. This is not likely to be the case, but economic sanction and low oil prices, you couldn't ask for a better combination to basically rein in the expansion, you know, policies of Putin. The same situation with the Iranian. They are, the export now is about 1.3 million barrels per day. Their production quota will supposedly be over 3 million barrels a day. They cannot fill their quota because they lack technology, they lack capital, they lack organization. So they are desperately in need of Western capital and technology, and that is not going to happen unless or until they abandon their nuclear program. And instead of a shooting war, nothing better than economic sanction, and that will bring them to the negotiating table without spilling blood. So I think it's a brilliant, strategy between the U.S. and the Saudis to bring both Russia and Iran down to earth.
And what is the relationship between Iran and Iraq? We know that Iran has tremendous influence over the Shiite government in Baghdad and the area in the south that adjoins Iran is where most of Iraq's oil is. Do you foresee a time when, for all intents and purposes, Iraq has ceased to be a country, but we, and believe it or not, the Iranians seem to be bent on trying to keep it together or to keep the illusion alive that it's still a country? We know that the Kurds have gone their own way and they have some oil. But what is there a future in which you could see Iran and Iraq in effect, the Shiite governments merging and becoming a huge oil player?
Not very likely. They will have obviously close relationship, but yes, they are both Shiite Muslim countries, but they're completely different culture, completely different language. One is Arab, the Iraqis are Arab basically, and the Iranian are Persians. They speak different language, they have different history, and so forth. But they are basically strange bedfellows when it comes to oil and Iraq, for all practical purposes, probably going to end up a three-way break like the former Yugoslavia. We're going to have the Kurd separate country, the Sunnis in separate country, and the Shiite in separate country. However, that is not going to happen anytime soon, peacefully, unless or until the oil revenue would be shared. And until or unless that happens, we are going to see the civil war, which will spill over to other parts of the Middle East. It's already in Syria. It's going to come to Egypt. It's going to go to Jordan. And even we see some signs of groups going into the Gulf, into Saudi Arabia, into Yemen, into Libya. So the situation in the Middle East could not have been worse. And to compound that with what is happening in oil prices, the collapse in oil prices, this government will become less popular and will probably some of them will collapse.
So when you talk about Iran needing to upgrade its oil infrastructure, the same is true of Iraq, and yet somehow that's never happened in spite of all of the idea. I think it was Alan Greenspan who said that the Iraq war was all about oil. Well, if that was what the whole thing was about, it doesn't look like anybody's benefited much.
Correct. The, you know, it's going to open a different subject, but you know, the Iraq war was a big mistake, both financially, politically. Every term you would want to put it, it was a massive mistake. So as the other war in Afghanistan, we basically lost trillions of dollars, and we're going back to square one and even worse. Having said that, yes, wars in the Middle East always about oil and security of oil supply. And the more and more the U.S. become energy independent, the less involvement the U.S. will have to be in the Middle East. This part of the world that has to really help itself. It has to be self-help. We just cannot introduce the democracy. We tried that in Egypt. It failed. We tried that in Libya. It failed. We tried that in Iraq. Obviously, it is big, big failure. And the same situation is in Afghanistan. We just cannot have these people run before they walk. They have to learn how to walk first, and will take probably another generation before they understand what the democracy is. They think anarchy is democracy. They think anarchy is the way to go. Everybody is free to do whatever they want, to carry guns and to shoot at people and property and so forth. So, again, the sooner we become energy independent, the more and more our foreign policy will not be dictated by oil supply or concern about future oil supply.
So just in closing, Fadel Guy, back to Russia and Iran and Nigeria and Venezuela having their budgets adversely impacted. If you say that Brent crude could, it's now at 60, it could get down to 50, this means a very different market ahead. It means, well, of course, they say that there's been more money in the pocket of the American consumer this Christmas because of falling gas prices. And yet you said that one of the things that we've never managed to do is to rein in speculation. So can the speculators come back and drive it up again?
Unfortunately, speculation is part and parcel of oil prices and has been for the last 15 years. And it is very difficult to rein in now. I see no hope for that. Politicians on both sides of the aisle, they seem to talk a lot, but they do very little to rein the financial speculation. And then they impose penalties, but if the gain is 10 times the penalty, people will commit the same crime over and over and over again. Only if they are sent to jail and if they are penalized 10 times what they got legally, then there will be some hope. But I don't see any hope of reining in any speculation in the pricing of oil any time soon.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Fadel Guy.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Fadel Guy, who is the Senior Vice President for Oil and Gas Research with Oppenheimer & Company. He has had more than 30 years of experience in oil and gas research and was previously with Mobil Oil and J.P. Morgan Company in New York. He's one of the most quoted analysts on energy issues and has testified before the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives about oil price speculation. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the Pope's recent visit to Turkey, as well as the leader of Turkey, Erdogan. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Graham Fuller, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He's lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam, A World Without Islam, and his latest, Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian.
And the Pope just had a visit to Turkey, and in Ankara, the Pope was the first foreign head of state to visit the grandiose billion-dollar, 1,000-room White Palace built by Turkey's president, some suggest, to house Erdogan's giant ego. What's the significance of that? Erdogan decided to meet with the Pope, have him as the first head of state to host him in this at his lavish villa palace?
Well, I think Erdogan obviously has growing ambitions and sense of himself as the supreme leader in Turkey, and is working to try to develop the mechanisms, the constitutional mechanisms, to grant him ever greater power within the country. Certainly, as you suggested, this new huge palace reflects his own ego, and I think he was very eager to show it off in the context of a important papal visit. So, yeah, we get some sense of where this man's mind and style is these days.
Well, of course, Turkey still has its at least vestiges of its original vision of secularism pioneered by Atatürk, and there were the laying of the wreaths at Atatürk's tomb, etc., part of the Pope's visit. But it is under Erdogan clearly, and he refers to the new Turkey. It's clearly both increasingly Islamist and it's also increasingly nationalistic, is it not?
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily call it Islamist so much as Islamic, and that may be too fine a distinction, but I don't yet sense that this is a major ideology that's going to change the country, even though some of the old-time secularists in Turkey do fear that. But no, I certainly Turkey sees itself as very much part of the West, among the rest of the part of the West as well as part of the East, and wants and believes that a visit from the Pope really signifies its coming of age and its significance in the region. It's interesting too, though, that that the embrace of the Pope comes at a time when Erdogan is at daggers drawn with the other major Islamic civil movement in Turkey, Hizmet, and is attempting to try to bring it to its knees as an alternative rival in as in the source of Islamic thinking. And that movement, Hizmet, has been in the forefront of talking about intercultural dialogue, interfaith dialogue, its leader having met with the Pope in the past. So there's some sparring beneath the surface even there.
Well, how much, though, does Erdogan's anger at the United States? We know he's angry at the U.S. over U.S.'s strategic incoherence in Syria. And we know that he's not allowing the U.S. to use the big NATO air base at Incirlik, even though Turkey's a NATO member. But he also seems to be, Erdogan seems to be obsessed with Gulen, who's the religious leader here in the United States, and he seems to be blaming the U.S. for hosting Gulen.
Well, right, but then that's been going on for quite a long time. I mean, if we look back at Gulen as the head of the Hizmet movement, there has been a struggle over this for a long time. Erdogan, the now president, has been quite happy to work with the Hizmet movement for a long time in strengthening civil Islamic activism within Turkey and outside of Turkey in the Gulen school system, which now reaches some 100 countries in the world, schools that are not particularly Islamic at all, but that are designed to promote education, particularly for Muslims. So anyway, this is a long struggle, and it's now reached a head, and I think the symbolism of who would greet the Pope and whether Erdogan is now taking over the role of spokesman for international dialogue is what's at issue here. But yeah, you're right. It goes beyond that. The irritation of Washington goes back, and it's not recent at all. As you know, it goes back at least 10 years when the ruling AKP party, still in power, has kind of declared a declaration of independence from being a close, loyal ally of the U.S. and striking out for a more independent policy of its own in the Middle East, much of it in opposition to contrary to what U.S. wishes are in the region, and in seeking Turkey's desire for dialogue with Iran and with Palestinian movements and with Hezbollah in Lebanon. It's all part of a increasing divide.
But what's at the heart then of this? Is Erdogan trying to expropriate the Gulen's movement by being with the Pope? Because my sense is that he's not entirely about a more inclusive Islam, a less austere version. I mean, certainly nothing like the Saudis, but is there a difference between Gulen and Erdogan? I mean, is Erdogan trying to expropriate but not really imitate?
Well, I don't think in terms of actual theology that there is a particularly major difference between Erdogan and the Hizmet movement. It's just that they are focusing on different things. Hizmet, as a civic movement, and it's the biggest civic movement in the Islamic world, it's focusing really on reconciliation, dialogue, the importance of education in raising the level of Muslim society and importance in the world, whereas Erdogan is a political leader and is now driven by advancing his own personal cause, his own personal standing within Turkish politics, his ability to dominate the system, if you will. So, and that is what Hizmet opposes. So it's not really theology at all. It's how politics should be run properly in Turkey.
And again, I'm speaking with Graham Fuller, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam, A World Without Islam, and his latest, Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. So there's certainly plenty to in terms of a power grab, if you will, by Erdogan for people to be concerned about. And we had, of course, the Gezi Park protests, and there seems to be on Erdogan's part a sort of disregard for environmentalism. This huge palace was built on a national park, and there, you know, he seems to have an edifice complex, shall we say. What's your sense then of how this is working? I mean, you seem to have some elements in Turkey outraged, particularly the young who got tear gassed into submission, his callous treatment of the miners who died in the mining collapse. And yet you read and hear from people in Turkey that there's a certain pride, even at this vast white palace that he's built.
Yeah, I don't know whether it's pride in the palace as such, but it's certainly Erdogan has put Turkey on the map in a way that no leader has since Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, who founded the country at nearly 100 years ago. So at this point, I think people pretty well recognize that Erdogan plays a rough political game. He's riding roughshod over a lot of the opposition. He's intimidating newspaper reporters and such. But the fact is that he, as I said, he has put Turkey on the map. Turkey's economy has now risen to be number 16 in the world. The standards of living in Turkey have risen dramatically under the last decade. So I think a lot of Turks may fear, he's a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch, and he's done a lot to improve our lives. And we don't see, frankly, at this point, anybody else out there who is a leader who would challenge him with sufficient credibility. That's the bottom line. This guy has gone on, has been elected now three times. The question is, you know, would he's his party has won three times in a row. He has now won the presidency. So it's hard to know what it will take to cause Turks to decide enough is enough, that this man is too grandiose in his ambitions. That moment certainly has not arrived. But I think there's a lot of stumbling room for him in quagmires such as this whole struggle against ISIS in particular, and where he's going to be able to take negotiations with the Kurds.
So let's focus in on that, Graham Fuller. There are reports now, A lot of it coming from the Kurdish fighters in Kobani, suggesting that the Turkish government is in complicity with the Islamic State and allowing them to attack Kobani from Turkish positions, and thus negate the advantages so far of U.S. bombing. There was a suicide attack that appeared to come from the Turkish border area that just happened. And a lot of people are suspicious that this goes back to some kind of deal that might have been made by Erdogan to get the Turkish diplomatic hostages who were taken in Mosul by the Islamic State, and that there's some connection there. So how much is this paranoia and how much of this is real?
There's no doubt that Turkey's, Erdogan, I should say, Erdogan's supreme ambition right now in that immediate area is the overthrow of Bashar al-Assad in Turkey. He brought Bashar al-Assad along over a 10-year period with very close relations, and felt that he had a superb working relationship with him, and was infuriated when the Arab Spring began in Damascus, and Assad, rather than following Erdogan's advice to take it easy with the protesters, took extremely harsh measures and refused to listen to any Turkish advice. So since that point, I think Erdogan feels that the fall of Assad has to be number five, if you will, among the leaders of the Middle East that have fallen during the Arab Spring. And he's determined to go that route. He's really dug in his heels and throwing good money after bad. He's been willing to deal with ever more radical Islamic forces in the region, Islamic jihadis, to bring down Assad, because sadly, the moderate Islamists and jihadis, if you can talk about it, moderate jihadis, have not been as effective as groups like that are linked with Al-Qaeda or with ISIS. So he's found himself pushed into a bit of a corner on this. I don't think he's actually seeking to have an ISIS victory in the area. Not at all. I think he appreciates the danger of it. But, you know, how far does he go in supporting increasingly radical groups to overthrow Assad and Damascus? Or how much should he back off? And I think he's still struggling with that, and now under increasing pressure from Obama to back away from anything which would suggest help or looking the other way to ISIS's own operations in the region. I don't think he's resolved this yet in his own mind.
Well, has the United States resolved it in its own mind? It has
well,
obviously.
Exactly. No, we haven't, and I, you know, you and I have talked about this before. I think there are two ways to essentially bringing an end to the ISIS phenomenon, which is an extraordinary phenomenon. First is to ensure that the new government in Baghdad, the new Shiite government in Baghdad, is far more conciliatory towards Sunnis and working with them in power sharing. That's vital. And secondly, I would argue bringing an end to the war in Damascus, in Syria, acknowledging that we cannot overthrow Assad, it's not about to happen, and that the cost is getting ever higher with more and more radical jihadis pouring into the region to try to overthrow this guy. So the victory against Assad would probably be worse than having Assad there. Erdogan has not yet reached that decision point. I don't know when and how he will do it, but he's under tremendous pressure and huge numbers of, you know, 1.5 million or more refugees from Syria pouring into the country. Turks are increasingly unhappy. This could be his major Achilles heel if he doesn't begin to rethink his policy. And it does affect the local Kurdish negotiations inside Turkey as well.
But if the United States is going to bank on the idea that the Shiite government in Baghdad are somehow going to heal the wounds that they have created in the first place by being so sectarian, that doesn't seem to be working. And the U.S. still seems to be holding out some kind of hope that they can organize some kind of secular opposition. Even though all of those guys are dead, I don't understand why the U.S. wasn't able to capitalize on the enormous defections from Assad's military early in the game. So how much do you think Obama is sort of trying to make up for his initial mistakes in essentially turning his back on the Syrian situation?
I think there was very good reason on Turkey's part and on Washington's part, and I'd have to say on my own part as well, to believe that Assad would be number five to fall in the series of leaders that fell in Tunisia and Egypt and Yemen and Libya and elsewhere in that period. But it became fairly clear, I think, after about 6 months, that this was a different dynamic, that there were lots and lots of Syrians who didn't like Assad, but who felt that he was a lot better than any successor who might come along, especially if it was going to be an Islamist kind of successor movement. Certainly, minorities felt very strongly that way. Christians, the Druze, as well as Jewish population, who had great fear of an Islamist takeover. So I think it was understandable that people thought that this was going to happen. But when it hasn't happened, and when we've seen that the only possible way maybe to bring about victory against Assad is to bankroll ever more radical jihadis, Obama has backed away. I don't know that this could have ever been any different. We banked on the fact that he would topple easily. He didn't. And I would argue it's now time to cut our losses and back off and hope for another day.
Well, Graham Fuller, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Graham Fuller, who is the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam, A World Without Islam, and his latest, Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into conditions in Venezuela as the oil-dependent economy suffers from the drop in oil prices. جيت النفجوز عيونه على صمار الحنطة
Porque está viejo y cansado, pero no se dan de cuenta que un corazón amarrado, cuando le sueltan las riendas, es caballo desbocado. Y si una potra la sana, caballo viejo se encuentra, el pecho se le desgrana y no le hace caso a faceta, y no le obedece a freno ni lo paran falsas riendas.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Antonio Gonzalez, the president of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, the oldest and largest nonpartisan Latino voter participation organization in the U.S. that has tripled its Latino registration from 5.4 million in 1994 to more than 14 million registrants in 2012. He is also the president of the William C. Velasquez Institute, a leading think tank that studies U.S. Latin American relations. And he is Time Magazine named Gonzalez as one of the 25 most influential Hispanics in America. And he currently hosts his own weekly radio program here at KPFK in Los Angeles, Strategy Session. Welcome to Background Briefing, Antonio Gonzalez.
Good morning, Ian.
And you're just back from Cuba and Venezuela. So we were talking early with a specialist on the falling oil prices, which could continue to fall. We were told that the now Brent crude's at $60 a barrel. It could go down to $50. And this has, of course, severe impacts on Russia's economy, on Iran's economy, but also on Venezuela's economy, where the prices have dropped from $99 a barrel to $69 a barrel since June. And since 96% of Venezuela's foreign currency comes from oil sales, what was your sense of, since you go to Venezuela a lot, what was your sense from your just recent trip? You just got back a day or so ago.
Well, this year, Venezuela will see a contraction in its GDP. It had been a country that was growing at a fair clip between, 3 and 6% for probably 10 years since the coup and oil strike in 2002, 2003, and 2004. So it's a big hit in Venezuela. There's a government announcement when I left of spending cutbacks, and also a big announcement by the president of a campaign against corruption, which is also an endemic problem. So a lot of austerity. There are it's a pretty good safety net in Venezuela that protects the very poor and the working class. So it'll be a challenge to see to what extent those protections are maintained and what is the popular response to government cutbacks. That the regime has tried to protect its the poorest in other times of downward oil prices. So we'll see.
Well, what will they do about the subsidies on gasoline, which for the American audience would be literally a dream? The idea that you pay, what, 5 cents a gallon?
It's incredibly cheap. It's basically free gasoline. And my sense is that's like the third rail of Venezuelan politics. The last time a government cut off, and it's not just Chavista, era subsidies. Gas has always been subsidized, and it's always been basically free in Venezuela. The last time the government tried to cut those subsidies was in the 1980s, and it caused an insurrection and then a mass repression that led to the rise of what is called the Bolivarian movement that propelled now deceased President Hugo Chavez to presidential victory. So that won't happen, but there's other things that I think I'm certain the regime will cut.
So in terms of life for the average Venezuelan, what my understanding is, first of all, that it has one of the highest crime rates in the world. I think Honduras is worse, but it's still pretty bad. That there have been periodic shortages of some of the staples like toilet paper and cooking oil. And if foreign exchange, it depends upon oil prices, already they were drying up. Apparently a lot of international air carriers had refused to fly in because they weren't getting any payments back in hard currency. So what is, are things deteriorating in terms of all of those issues, crime, inflation, et cetera?
I think they are. I think the approval ratings of the government are down to about 40%. I've got a number of pollsters that I talked to. So the what was previously dissent among the affluent classes and among the in the opposition has now bled into this group. There's a group called lightheartedly, the Los Ninis, ni Chavez ni la oposición, which is essentially the American equivalent, would be the non-independent, not affiliated to any party group, which is about 20%. So they're now not happy. But the Chavista base seems to be pretty firm, which is about 40%, which is hard. This is especially the poor, the working class, the poor, the organized, which is a very large group in Venezuela, the rural population. And the shortages certainly upset people, but the narrative up to this time has been that this is the doing of the private sector. The private sector is still robust in Venezuela. It is not a socialist economy by any stretch of the imagination. Means of production and distribution are still in private hands. And so there was a lot of hoarding going on. But at root of it is an unsustainable exchange system that the Venezuelan government put in to protect the Venezuelan producers and Venezuelan consumers, which has just caused this inflationary spiral to take off. It's caused shortages because the private sector can't get what they consider to be a fair price for their goods. So there's a lot of private production gets siphoned off into Colombia. There's this robust smuggling that goes across the Colombian-Venezuelan border. They share a vast border, 1,000-mile border. And they get a better price in Colombia. So there's a lot of disequilibriums in the economy. That being said, the people that I have a knowledge of tell me that the foreign exchange rate will be unified sooner than later, which should put a clamp down on inflation and should eliminate the shortages. When I went earlier this year, shortages were much worse, and they seemed not nearly as bad this time. Although there's still some, and it's, sort of in this region, but not this region, butter. In Caracas, I noticed a shortage of butter, but toilet paper was fine. I visited the supermarket, it seemed fine. Went to several restaurants, seemed fine. So it is slowly returning to normalcy. But the question is, with elections a year off, can they eliminate these problems? It's a big jump, Ian, that they have to take, which is unifying the currency, because that would mean a devaluation of the buying power for the Venezuelan Chavista base. That's who they're protecting. They have four different exchange rates, and it's just protect the base's standard of living. They've done it up to now, but in order to return the economy to growth and production, in order to enable the private sector to begin again with a normal sort of cycle, they have to do this devaluation and unification of the currency. And that's the government is divided. You know, part of it says, no, we have to protect our base. And part of it says, yes, we have to do it before the elections or else we'll lose Congress. And we have to, you know, get the economy back to health. So we'll see.
Again, I'm speaking with Antonio Gonzalez, the president of the Southwest Photo Registration Education Project. He currently hosts his own weekly radio show here at KPFK in Los Angeles, the Strategy Session on Mondays at 4 p.m. And he is the president of the William C. Velasquez Institute, a leading think tank that studies U.S.-Latin American relations. And he's just returned from Cuba and Venezuela. So obviously, what you've just described, Antonio, is puts Maduro in a vice, because if he goes the way of favoring the broader economy over the subsidizing the poor, he's going to have defections, which he's already having from his party, which was of course the party that Chavez organized to put all of the opposition under put all of the government supporters under one umbrella. On the other side, that's the PSUV. On the other side, it seems that the opposition is equally disunited in the sense that the Democratic Unity Alliance is almost as divided, and it only has about a quarter of the electorate that trusts it, my understanding is.
Yeah, it's often been said by my Venezuelan friends that the best ally of the revolutionary government is the disorganized counter-revolutionary movement. And make no bones about it, the opposition is a clear counter-revolution. They have attempted coups. They tried to foment an insurrection about a year ago. They all kinds of conspiracies there abound, and they will move to do a referendum to recall President Maduro in 2016, because given the givens, they will gain perhaps a majority of the Congress, but even if they don't, they will gain a significant number of seats, despite their being disorganized, just because of the bad situation in the economy. I think the gamble, and I think it's a smart one, and it's needed on behalf of the government, is to lay their hopes on two big campaigns, which they've rolled out. One is to introduce a new national police force that cracks down on crime, and it's true, it's real. Although Venezuela has always been a high crime society, it's even higher now because the police force has been inept. So they've trained a new police force, and they've begun to introduce it, and hopefully crime will come down. That's one gambit they're making. And the other is to launch an internal corruption campaign. And I literally saw the president on last Monday give a speech in which he announced the campaign to ferret out corruption and punish the there's a lot of stealing going on outside and inside the regime, outside by the private sector and inside by corrupt officials. Saying that you can't be a revolutionary and be corrupt. And those are incompatible. Those words have never been said before, and it was a clear signal to the stealing that's going on inside the different government bureaucracies that there's a target on your back now. Those two things would do a tremendous amount to restore faith. You know, it's said, normal Venezuelans say that they used to love Chavez, but not Chavistas. And if the Chavistas clean their house, that will make a tremendous impact in terms of the elections, which is basically about, which should be about next November or December.
So just in the last couple of minutes, Antonio Gonzalez, what's going to happen, though, with this increasing confrontation between the so-called colectivos, which support the government, they're sort of enforcers of the government, they channel money into the barrios, and they confront criminal gangs, they also intimidate political opponents. the former interior minister just got forced out because he took on the colectivos. This is a General Torres, former head of SEBIN, the intelligence service. He's been replaced, but clearly there are frictions between the military and the colectivos.
I think it goes on. The colectivos are considered a core element of the Bolivarian Revolution, as is the military, but they're on different sides of the ideological spectrum. As you can imagine, the military is a sort of patriotic nationalist. We don't expect any coups or anything to come from them. They have a history of being progressive, like other Latin American militaries. It's interesting. Some militaries are at the heart of fascism and dictatorship in Latin America, and some are have progressive histories. But the colectivos are the socialist vanguard, if you will, as are the communal councils, which are forms of 21st century socialism in the jargon of the revolution. And I don't expect them to be eliminated or to be the losers in some kind of power struggle. And it's not clear that there is a general power struggle. It's clear that there's abuses on both ends. And this may well be one of the targets of Maduro's speech. You know, corruption is not going to be allowed. There's mechanisms being put into place. The forcing out of that interior minister and being replaced by Freddy Bernal, I think many are seen as a good thing. Mm-hmm. He was just not up to the job, and Freddy Bernal is widely considered as an effective revolutionary leader who is going to put order in the House.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Antonio Gonzalez.
Thank you, Ian Masters. It's always a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Antonio Gonzalez, the president of the Southwest Photo Registration Education Project and the president of the William C. Velasquez Institute, a leading think tank that studies U.S.-Latin American relations. He also has a program here at KPFK, the strategy sessions on Mondays at 4 p.m. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.